Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and it's another book club day. And this time we're talking about the book titled The Peacekeeper with the author, Brooke Blanchard. She's with us. Brooke writes as B.L. Blanchard. She's a graduate of UC Davis Creating Writing Honors Program. Writing fellow at Boston University School of Law. She's also a lawyer. She's an enrolled member of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians, and she's originally from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. So as we talk with Brooke about her book, maybe you're wondering about the writing process or the research she did to bring Anishinaabeg language to life on the page. Want to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Brooke Blanchard, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, for the Larry Mueller Show book club book, we always look for, for one thing, we want to promote books and ones that we're not sure receive enough attention for sure. We also have some criteria about the book, either the author being from Wisconsin or the book taking place at least in part in Wisconsin. And when we saw your book and looked at it and saw the context of it, I thought, oh man, this is going to be great. And it is, it's a great book. I really enjoyed it. There's so many aspects to the book, the Peacemaker. It's a murder mystery. It's also a story about letting go of guilt, I think we could say, maybe without giving too much or giving everything away. For those who haven't read it, give us an overview of your book.
Sure. It's an alternate history, so it's sort of the what if. And it's set in 2020. I wrote the book in 2019, but I guess I knew in some part I would want an alternate version of that year. So it's set in 2020 in an America that was never colonized. And by America, I mean the continent, not the country, but because the US and Canada don't exist. And it's a world where colonization never happened. And so it's an industrialized, modern 21st century Anishinaabe society. And in it, in the village of Bawitagong, which we know in our world is Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, there's a peacekeeper named Chibanashi. Peacekeepers are, I guess, the closest analog is a police officer in a very sleepy small town. 20 years ago, his mother was murdered, his father confessed, and you know, they've kind of limped along ever since in his family. And then 20 years later, his mother's best friend is found murdered as well. And lacking any local leads, he has to go to the big city of Chicago, which we know in our world is Chicago. And in Chicago are two things he never wanted to deal with again. One is his father is incarcerated there. And the other is the woman who broke his heart has since moved there. So he has to go into this brave new world and try to solve a mystery and also repair some things in his own history.
I wondered how the heck you came up with the idea or the inspiration for the Peacekeeper. Not everybody would think of something like this.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, a lot of people think about all the time. I was not one of them. I live in San Diego and I work in downtown San Diego, and the freeway I take takes you through, it's a beautiful drive, takes you through Balboa Park and spits you right out into downtown. So I'm listening to a podcast, I'm just driving, and I get this kind of image pop into my head. It's a high rise building, a skyscraper, and almost like a cathedral stained glass window, there's a dream catcher sort of carved into the side. And I thought, oh, that's very interesting. And if you want a thought experiment that will occupy you for years or even a lifetime. Try to imagine a world without colonization, where it had never happened. There's a million ways you can go with it. I went down rabbit hole after rabbit hole, and you know, the more you think about it, the more possibilities come to you.
Maybe tell us, talk a little more about what the world looks like in the book.
Sure. So it's a world that there was no overseas colonization by Europe ever. And so that's sort of the premise. There's actually a companion book to this that was published last year called The Mother, and it shows what Europe and specifically Britain looks like without the British Empire in the present day. In the world of the Peacekeeper, where we're in the Great Lakes, it's a Great Lakes nation called Minowaki, which means the good land. It's borderless. There are no defined borders anywhere. It's a modern present day. So people have smartphones. There is television. There's high-rise buildings. There are sustainable buildings in both village level as well as the city level. So in Bawi Tagong, there are wigwams, but they are, you know, wigwams as they would be built today. So they are multiple stories. They are heated. You know, they have internal heating, but it's still communal living. In Chicago, the big city, there are vertical forests, which are high-rise buildings that have trees and plants built into them. So you're bringing nature into industry. The way I thought about it is you're incorporating that nature into a major city as opposed to paving over it. And that's not my invention, by the way. They've been proposed or built all over the world. It's a world where there's a different criminal justice system. That's another big part of it. It's not a punitive system as we have in our world. Rather than focusing on punishing the defendant, punishing the accused, you're focusing more on making the victim whole. And if you shift the focus of the criminal justice system, what does that look like? So those, I think, are probably the big things. But
yeah, it's really interesting. You know, when I looked at your book first, by the way, the cover is great.
Fantastic.
The person who put the cover together did a wonderful, wonderful job. But when I opened the book, the first thing I saw was this map. And
yes.
I thought, oh, good, a map. And I'm looking at the map, and I'm, what the heck? And I finally turned the map about upside down to sort of orient myself better, because it looked like, wait, what? Where is this place? And then I said, oh, okay. When I turned it upside down, I sort of oriented it. Was there some reason for the orientation that way?
Sure. So for those who might not be familiar, the first page is a map, and it is North America kind of flipped on its side. So instead of north being pointed toward the top, it's east. And the reason for that is actually an Anishinaabe tradition, and many North American tribes, the direction that you orient toward is not north, but rather east, the direction of the rising sun. And I am a huge map nerd. We could spend the whole hour just nerding out over maps, and I will be so happy. Fun fact is that maps being oriented toward the north is actually more a matter of, you know, custom as opposed to any real reason. You can orient them in any direction. Sometimes you'll see, you know, in the southern hemisphere or in Australia, they'll show what looks like the earth turned upside down. That would be valid. So that's one reason why. And also it's a little hint that the perspective is literally different in this book. It's not the America that everyone lives in now. It's the world that could have been, but it's literally and figuratively a new view of it.
Yeah, I actually went back to that map more than once when I was reading, just to sort of reorient my, our main protagonist, Chibanashi, traveled around a little bit. But I thought it was really cool. I was glad you had it in there. And I'm glad to hear what your reasoning was for it. you know, is this genre of speculative fiction or alternative history, what do you find most interesting about that approach?
I think I like that there's a definite starting point. You pick a moment in history and you think, well, what else could have happened? And really commonly you'll see, you know, what if World War II had ended differently? What if the Nazis had won? Or you'd see, what if the Civil War had ended differently? You know, what if the South had won? Or, you know, those I think come up a lot, but there are so many ways it could have gone. And I think it forces us to think about decisions that were made and sort of the alternate timelines that could have existed. There's a really great alternate history novel by Michael Chabon. It's called The Yiddish Policeman's Union. And that was one that I read before writing this one because I loved the idea of it. And it took a real moment in history, which was a proposed Jewish settlement in Sitka, Alaska, that I believe it failed by only one vote in the Senate. The idea was to create sort of a haven for Jewish refugees, and it failed, and so it wasn't created. But it looks in the present day, the book was written, I think, about 20 years ago, what it would look like had there been a Jewish settlement in Alaska starting in the early 40s, and how the culture would have evolved and how history would have been different. I think that's a really interesting thing to think about, because I think it tells us how small changes could really lead to wildly different outcomes, and some of them for the better, some for the worse. I like to think the Peacekeeper is not a bad outcome that could have happened, but there are others where, you know, it would make you grateful that things did turn out the way that it did.
Chibonacci, and he works as a peacekeeper. Maybe you could talk a bit more about what his work was. How's it different maybe from maybe being a detective?
Well, he's a peacekeeper in a very small village where there really isn't much crime. There isn't a whole lot for him to do. At one point in the book, someone points out really his job is kind of recovering lost property, because that's the biggest thing that tends to happen here. In this, you know, this is a society that's built with Anishinaabe worldviews. Community is paramount, and everyone is sort of expected to keep an eye on each other as well as support each other. And so if there is some sort of aberration, if there is a crime committed, you haven't just hurt the victim, you haven't just hurt yourself, you've hurt the community as a whole. And that different sense of responsibility, at least in this book, means that there is less crime, because you are thinking about yourself in the context of a larger whole, not just you as the individual. So as a result, he doesn't do a whole lot. There isn't a lot for him to do. And he's not the best at his job as a consequence.
Wasn't classically trained, for sure.
No. And in fact, someone pointed that out to me, like, he's not very good at his job. And I said, I know, he's not. Because he just doesn't have that much hands-on experience. And that actually isn't, you know, too uncommon either. I listened to a podcast several years back. It's called In the Dark, and it was very popular. It was about an unsolved missing persons case in the 80s in, I think, Minnesota, and how it there was no reason for it to take 30 years to be solved, and basic steps in policing had been missed by this very small town. And had they taken basic steps like canvassing the neighborhood and interviewing people, they probably would have found this person much more quickly. And how that's not limited to that town, it's in big cities, small towns, everywhere. So I wanted to show this is one where, you know, people are making errors, and it is, and they are missing things and getting better at their job. So I think that's probably his, you know, he's, for what he does most of the time, he's not bad at it, but give him a bigger crime to solve. He meets another peacekeeper who's like, man, you guys don't know what you're doing, and we're going to help you because we know better than you. And imagine you're in a new place. It's a place you don't want to be. And you've met someone who's not only just personally very annoying to you, he's also better at your job than you are. Fortunately, I really went through a lot.
Brooke Blanchard. our guest today. Her book is titled The Peacekeeper. And you can join in. Questions, thoughts, comments, the number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about the book today titled The Peacekeeper, and Brooke Blanchard, she writes as B.L. Blanchard, our guest today to talk about it, enjoying it. Questions for her, again, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. You're a lawyer, too, and I'm at your knowledge of the current justice system certainly probably helped in many ways. But the mediation scenes in the book were really intriguing to me. And I guess I didn't know very much about mediation and how it works. Describe it in the book, and is this how we do it today?
So mediation is a form of, in the real world, it's what we call a form of alternative dispute resolution. So instead of going to court, everyone gets, you often hire like a retired judge or an experienced attorney who will come in and try to help the parties reach a settlement. And that's how most civil cases, lawsuits get resolved, is through some sort of informal settlement, and a lot of times with the help of a mediator. And the mediator will help you figure out, you know, okay, can you kind of help the parties reach an agreement? In the book, it's used, now we use that for civil cases. In criminal cases, we use the plea bargaining system often, where you will kind of reach a deal to plead guilty, maybe to a lesser offense or for a reduced sentence or things like that. In the book, that is what we have instead of the trial and jury system. And so this is how, based on Navajo peacemaker courts, which are used by the Navajo Nation. I also look to the Japanese criminal justice system for some of this as well. And what it is instead of a, you know, judge, jury, you know, you've got the defendant on trial, did they do whatever thing they're being accused of? And that is the focus, is the defendant guilty or not guilty? And we're going to sit in judgment of that person. In a peacemaker court and in the system in the Peacekeeper, everyone's focusing on the victim. What would make the victim whole? And it's a concept in the law called restitution. Again, this is a civil law concept, but it can also be used in criminal law. How have you been wronged, and what would help make you whole? So that's the focus of the criminal justice system in the Peacekeeper, is we have a victim and here's how they've been wronged. And it could be anything from a small thing all the way up to murder. How do we make this person whole from what's happened? What could the accused do? And it's premised on them accepting responsibility for it. What can they do to help resolve this and make it whole? And so that's the focus there. So it's not on how do we punish, it's how do we repair? And that's and so in the book, Chibanashi's father is incarcerated, and that is a punishment of last resort. Most people aren't incarcerated. It's considered the worst of the worst thing that could happen. And so it's called like a decarceral society. It's one where we don't throw people in jail. We try to make people better.
Yeah, that was really, really fascinating to me to read those scenes. Chibanashi, he struggles a lot with guilt and grief and finding his way a bit throughout the novel. In some ways, I think the book is a story about a man finding himself.
Yeah, it's him finding himself when he was 17. His mother is brutally murdered, and murder just does not happen where he lives. And his father immediately confesses to it. So he's lost both and is imprisoned. He's lost both parents as a result. And he has to take care of his sister, Ashwiye, for, you know, basically the rest of his life. And she has significant trauma, as does he. So these are two very broken people who isolated themselves from the rest of the community. They haven't really dealt with their trauma. And so it's figuring out how to overcome that years and years later, because I'm of the belief it's never too late to try to do that. But you do it when you're ready. And it took them a long time to get there.
Do you have a reading? Is there a piece in the book that you read that might capture maybe part of that, or or just one that you like to read during these times when you're talking to people about your book?
Yes, there is. This is a scene toward the beginning of the work. It takes place in a medicine lodge with Wakui, the medicine woman, who is the elder in the village, who she's there for religious, spiritual reasons, but she's also in for Chibanashi. She's really just sort of there as almost a therapist for him. And he's come to her to talk about some dreams he's had, you know, his trauma. The anniversary of his mother's death is coming up. That's always a difficult time for him. And she's trying to help him, you know, try to start to heal. And so they're sitting together and she's telling him, "You must dream. Without dreams, his spirit would," she said, "without dreams, his spirit would be rooted to the physical world. Spirits needed to be free to communicate between this world and the next, and dreams were the conduit." She stood and went to the shelves behind her. She dangled a branch wrapped in a circle with a deer sinew threaded around it like a spider web. Three feathers dangled from the bottom. "But if you do need assistance," Chibanashi swatted the dream catcher away. "I'm not a child," he sighed. "Besides, I already have one. It does nothing." "So you agree," Wakui said, "that it's better to face the dreams than to block them." "Please," he croaked out. "If you try to keep it out, it will only appear to you more forcefully than before. You must confront it. Learn to let it not hold you hostage." She took a few padded footsteps toward him and knelt down. "Remember the cycle of life." Wakui raised her hand up and pointed a finger straight between his eyes. "Creation." She drew her hand down in a half circle, stopped at the bottom. "Destruction." She drew the other half of the circle and stopped her finger between his eyes again. "Recreation." She drew the circle again, this time without pause. "Your mind and heart want to be here," she said, pointing to the top of the invisible circle. She dropped her finger to the bottom. "But it's stuck here. It wants to rise, but it cannot because your guilt weighs you down. To get from here," she pointed to the bottom, "to here," she drew her finger to the top, "is the journey of life. It's a circle that repeats over and over. Destruction is meant to be recovered from. Recreation of something more beautiful and stronger than what existed before awaits. But you have to be willing to make that climb."
Oh, that's a great part, and tells us a lot. It's kind of a central little statement in the book early on.
Yeah, it sort of lays out the map for what the journey he's about to go on. He's been through trauma. There's been destruction. He's got to rebuild. You can't go back to where you were before, but you have to rebuild, hopefully something better.
Dan in Superior, let's go to you. Dan, thank you for calling.
Hi, it's actually Jan. Thank you so much. I was in the UP for 7 years, another UPer. I worked in Brimley as a student volunteer for some time. My question is how your time in the Upper Peninsula, if you're close to Brimley, for example, how that affected where you are today. In the late 60s, we had an extremely small number of people from the reservation around Brimley, for example, going to college. Upward Bound was a program that may have affected you. Any ways that your life in the Upper Peninsula has affected where you got today? It's so wonderful to hear success stories in today's world.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Brooke, comment?
Sure. We moved out of the UP to Northern California when I was still a kid. And for a variety of reasons, my father became estranged from his family. So I didn't reconnect with them until I was almost 20 years old. But when I did, I started going back regularly. Most of my family still lives in Gould City, which is on the Lake Michigan side. It's a very, very small town. I love it. I think it's the most beautiful place on earth. Especially in the summer. I've lived in California too long to go back in the winter. but it's wonderful. As to how it's affected, I mean, I have wonderful family who I'm so grateful to be connected with. I wish I could go back to the UP more often. But every time I'm there, I really feel like I'm home. And I remember the first time going back since my childhood. I was, 19, almost 20, and driving. I drove up from Chicago through actually Wisconsin all the way up. And just the closer I got to Menominee, which is your first stop in the UP on that drive, the more it really, really felt like home. I remember driving through Peshtigo and just the topography starts to change and I just felt pulled back there. So it's wonderful. I mean, both of my parents are from the UP, my father from Gould City, my mother's from Marquette. My maternal grandmother is from Hooton, and I guess the best way I can describe it is it's a singular place on earth and one that I kind of feel like I lost a lot by not spending more of my childhood there between the time we moved away and the time I came back and started reconnecting with my family. But I'm so grateful for it, and it allowed me to reconnect with my Chippewa culture. I had primarily been in touch with my mother's side of the family for a long time, and they're the non-Chippewa side. So it's just a wonderful place if you haven't been.
Dan, thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. Chibanashi is the primary caretaker for his sister, Ashwia. It's a role that takes a big toll on his health. Why is he so devoted to her?
He feels like he failed. When I was writing him, I tried, for every character, I always try to figure out I called it their prime directive. What is their thing that drives them throughout? And in his case, it's protect his sister, because when his mother was murdered, he was out drinking with his buddies. He was passed out. He missed everything. And he has always felt that if he hadn't been so irresponsible, he might have been able to stop it. And his sister witnessed it and has never been the same since. So his drive is always to protect her. Every decision he makes is governed by that. And it all goes back to that night. So he wants desperately to undo it, which obviously he can't. He can't go back in time. So he's tried to make up for it ever since and let his devotion to her be the primary driver of his life. And he's given up a lot for it. The love of his life wanted to move away to the big city. Her prime directive is she's very ambitious. She said, let's go to Chicago. I'm going to be an advocate, which is a lawyer in that universe. And he's like, I can't leave my sister. And at one point he describes it as, he loved Dawkinson, his love, but he loved his sister more. And that's why he stayed there his whole life, because he wanted to be with her and protect her.
Yeah, interesting. Sharon in Green Bay has something. Let's go there. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Larry and Brooke. I'm a librarian. I'm really enjoying your book talk today. While I haven't read this particular book, it's on my to-read list, but my question for Brooke is, we've definitely over the years seen more Indigenous authors coming to the forefront. Have you found it challenging in your writing journey to get publishers to take notice?
I don't think it was any more so than anyone else who's trying to get published. It's hard. It's hard to get it. It's hard to finish a book. It's hard to get an agent. It's hard for that agent to sell your book to a publisher, and it's hard to get a readership. I'm so thrilled that there are so many Indigenous authors who are getting so much attention, and really, really great books coming out. Some of my favorites are Stephen Graham Jones, in particular, his horror novel, The Only Good Indians, David Heska Wambly Wyden's Winter Counts, that's a contemporary murder mystery. Erica Wirth has a horror novel called White Horse that I really love. Rebecca Roanhorse, she writes fantasy. Tommy Orange has a literary fiction novel called They're There. There's a lot of great Indigenous horror, Indigenous speculative fiction. We're really in a wonderful time where so many authors can get that kind of exposure, and I feel very fortunate to be one of them.
Yeah, and you it probably took you a while to get this whole process. I mean, getting a book published, finding as you say, finding even an agent, I imagine, the right agent, is a task.
It is. I wrote the book while I was on maternity leave, and because I thought I have two children now. I'm never going to have free time again in my life. It's now or never when I'm only taking care of a newborn and a 4-year-old. So, you know, writing it is a challenge, finishing it is a challenge. The research took a really long time, just trying to create the world and, you know, figuring a lot of things out. And then getting an agent is tough. It's called the querying process. You have to be prepared for a lot of rejection. I'm fortunate that I have a wonderful literary agent and we found a great publisher in 47 North. But yeah, it's any professional writing is, I've always described it as you're swimming through a sea of rejection and a sea of no's to get to those small nuggets of yes here and there, but it's worth it. And I love writing just for its own sake. Even if I weren't published, I would still do it.
So. Oh, that's great. The names in the, I tell you, there are a fair number of kind of, well, there's one, you know, really main character, Chibonacci, but there are a lot of characters in the book and the names. How did you choose the names for the characters? And I think each person's name means something, right?
Each person's name does mean something. I tried not to tie it too close to personalities necessarily. I was mindful that these Anishinaabe names might be difficult for a lot of readers. Just to list through a few of them, our main character is Chibonacci, his sister's Ashuye, his ex-girlfriend is Dakison, the other peacekeeper is Takumwa. Confession, he's my favorite character in the whole book. There's Pijaki, who's the lead peacekeeper. Ishkode was his father. Meokwani is his mother's best friend. Nibin, his mother. I'm well aware that these are probably not names most readers are going to be familiar with. So I tried to find, and some Anishinaabe names are really, really, really long. So I tried to use names that are relatively short. That would be, I think, easier to learn to pronounce. And I also made sure that each character's name starts with a different letter of the alphabet so that if the name is a little difficult to pronounce, you could see, okay, it's the C character, the T, the D, the A, and follow them that way. I've read a lot of books where even if there's like a Dave and a Dan and you have to keep them straight, I've completely confused them before. My sister, you know, said when she was reading Lord of the Rings, Arwen and Eowyn, she was like, I can't. She, until the movie came out, she got them very confused. So that was my attempt to make it as accessible as possible, but at the same time, you know, I'm not going to name them, you know, Steve or anything like that. So that just wouldn't be true to the world. So, but I also think, you know, we learn to pronounce a lot of complicated names that are not, you know, necessarily familiar to an English speaking world. So if you can master things like Tchaikovsky or, Dostoevsky, you can probably handle some Anishinaabe ones.
Oh, they were, I like the names. I mean, it took a while just to kind of, as I read along to, you know, and I'm paying pretty close attention because I know we're going to talk. but Takumwa, you know, I agree with you. I thought you can get another book out of Takumwa. I just liked his personality and his smarts and, I don't know, just the way he approached life.
He's basically if a golden retriever's personality was grafted onto a human. Everyone is his new best friend. He does not know when to shut up. He's a talker, and Chibonacci's very reserved. He's almost in a defensive crouch and has been for most of his life. So he got someone who's like, hey, best friend, this is my new best friend. And he won't stop talking. And again, he's better at his job than Chibonacci is at his. That is kind of his own personal nightmare. But yeah, I loved him. I've had in the back of my mind, I would love to do Takumwa's tragic backstory, but I don't have anything fleshed out. I kind of like the mystery of it more, but yeah, he was a lot of fun to write. I always describe it as I was writing the book and then he shows up, you know, he swings open the door midway through a sentence and he didn't stop talking. And I just completely fell in love with him.
Yeah, I liked him a lot. Let's talk about the place names for a minute, too, and the meetings on those place names. I wondered if Chicago, which is what we know as Chicago, I wondered if that was, as I was reading, I wonder if that was a native word for that area that got somehow changed along the way to Chicago.
From what I've been able to tell, yes, it's a Miami word, and it means, you know, the place where the onions grow, at least in the research I did. There are other words for it. There is an Anishinaabe name for it, and it's escaping me at the moment. But there are other native words, but that's the one that I saw come up most often, and I thought it sounded, I decided to use that for a couple reasons. One, I thought it was similar enough to Chicago that it would help orient readers as to where we are. But also, I wanted to show that this was not utopia. And
yes,
pre-Columbian, there were lots of disputes and wars between different nations. And I wanted to show that the Anishinaabe had sort of subsumed some other cultures around it as the dominant cultural force. And Tecumseh is actually a Miami character, and he calls out Chibonacci saying, "This is our word. You don't call, you know, Chicagua is a Miami word, and our language doesn't get spoken anymore, and our culture is being erased." And Chibonacci kind of harumphs a little bit, you know, and gets kind of his back against the wall, feeling attacked about it. But I did want to bring that in there, because if it's a perfect world, that's boring, number one. And number two, it just wouldn't be true to history. So I wanted to include that for a couple of different reasons, but it was important to me that it be a non-Anishinaabe name for it, because I wanted to show sort of that discord and that history.
Brooke Blanchard, our guest today. She is the author of our book club selection, which is titled The Peacekeeper. Join in with your questions, comments, or I hope you will. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking with my guest, author B.L. Blanchard. Brooke Blanchard is the author of The Peacekeeper, and really enjoying talking with her about this, about her book. Join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@WPR.org. You mentioned a little bit, Brooke, about Chicagua itself. And you know, Chibonacci sees people, gets a little bit surprised at what a big city like Chicagua is like.
Yes.
So, I mean, there's people on this living on the streets and so forth.
Yeah, again, this isn't utopia. And where he comes from, it's a small town. Everyone takes care of each other. The idea of someone sleeping on the streets or needing to beg is just completely foreign to him, because this is not a capitalist society. It's not a communist society. It's different from the world we're in, but it's one where, generally speaking, if you have extra, you share it, and if you need, you receive. And he gets to this big city, and he realizes that this foundational core value of his is not being followed. It's one of the first things he sees, and he's horrified. And Tecumseh was like, well, you know, it's nothing's perfect, but he's horrified. And he sees that, you know, there's hypocrisy in a lot of different ways throughout. There's a character who is an economics professor, and he's lecturing on, you know, how ideal this economic system is. But, you know, at the same time, he lives in much greater luxury than most people. He's all but disowned his own son. So he's not living up to the values that he was just a few minutes earlier espousing as being this wonderful foundation. And so, yeah, people are dishonest in that society, as they are in any society. I wanted to try to populate this real world with real people, and that meant none of them could be perfect.
You know, There are, just thinking about culture a little bit, there are some customs and stories I think a reader familiar with Anishinaabe culture would recognize. That, and the story begins during Manoman, or Manuman, is, how is that pronounced? Is it Manoman?
Manoman.
Yeah, Manoman. Maybe talk about the significance of Manoman for both the characters in your book and people today.
So Manoman is the only grain that's native to the Great Lakes region, and it's a staple food for the Anishinaabe people. And it's dancing the rice and harvesting it, and we call it dancing it to get the grain from the husk. You actually put it, you dig a little hole in the ground, you put a covering on top of the hole, you pour the rice in there, you stand on it, you hold on to two logs, and you dance it. I've never done it, but I've got, my dad does it every year. And I wanted to include that. I also wanted there to be a major holiday, but I also wanted to be able to put my own spin on it. So I thought I want a tradition that is important, but also, and is still celebrated today, but I wanted to show it being a bigger, a different looking event. Because again, this is a world where, you know, our culture was never trampled the way that it was in reality. So that's, you know, I want it to be one, the big holiday that everyone travels for and all the families reunite for. And it's just a fun, happy event that will end in tragedy by the next morning.
Yeah. And it's his place is a tourist place. Oh, by the way, I have every week I buy a loaf of bread, which is wild rice and cranberry bread. And it is the most delicious bread you are ever going to eat. I love that bread. But that took me off my train of thought here for a minute. Another character, thinking culture again here, another character goes to great lengths to retrieve a beaded bag. And it means a lot to him. Traditionally, what are these bags called and why are they important?
So the bags are important because historically they were made by women for men. And they are sort of like a crossbody satchel with very intricate designs on them. And what I wanted to show was that it was really a way of showing a relationship between a son and his mother who had been estranged for a very, very long time and had never reconciled. And so using that bag as sort of, okay, they haven't been able to communicate. Their relationship has been, I don't want to spoil too much, but their relationship has not been good and they've barely been in touch, but he's going to go to great lengths to get this bag because otherwise, you know, that's all he has left to her. And I wanted one that, because I don't think in, you know, modern American society, we think of men carrying around very ornate beaded crossbody bags. So I wanted something that might look a little different, but also have a tremendous amount of significance to that person.
And there's also mention of the creation, the creature called Wendigo.
Yes.
What is that, and what does it represent in the story?
So it's a large cannibalistic wolf-like creature with antlers is how it's usually depicted. There's a Stephen King novel where there's one. I think it was Pet Sematary. Physically that's what it is, and it's the nightmare of stories. In Anishinaabe culture, it's more symbolic of greed and hatred and failing to contribute to your community, and also just being very hurting others. And so here we talk in this book, it talks about, okay, we're going to tell the little 4-year-old child the scary story about it, but among adults it's more of a symbolism of, you know, how someone could really become hurtful to others and kind of become soulless as well.
I wanted also to go back to the architecture that you talk about in the book, which I think is different in so many respects from our reality. These living skyscrapers and vertical forests. Describe that for our listeners.
So the picture, you know, your standard high-rise building, maybe it has a lot of balconies on it, maybe it's a large apartment building. You know, where I live in Southern California, high-rise buildings all have balconies because the weather's nice and we like being outside. But instead of it just being this concrete and glass and steel slab, it has large patios on which you have trees and bushes and flowers. You kind of take in the forest and all sorts of plant life, and you're incorporating that into the structure set. Instead of having this, you know, large industrial structure, you are incorporating the world into it. It's a form of sustainable architecture. It's one that allows, especially bird and insect life to thrive in an urban environment. And it's just one that I thought, if you were to have a modern indigenous society, that's how it would have been built, so that it's, you know, again, more sustainable. You're not paving things over, you're making it more alive and more incorporating the natural world into it. And I looked through, there's places in China and in the Middle East and South America that have really done this, and hopefully we'll see it more in America.
Yeah, I went online and looked, I just typed in sustainable buildings or something like that, and there were some photos of just absolutely fantastic. Of course, I did this after reading your book, and I wonder if there are places like this. You do such a nice job of describing that place or those places in your book. It was really fascinating to me, so I went ahead and looked, and they are fantastic. So you had to do a broad range of research for this book.
It was a lot of research. Yeah, a lot of the architecture. I actually talked to a friend of mine, her husband's architect. I was asking him questions about it, about, you know, pre-Columbian Anishinaabe culture. I talked to the cultural department of my tribe, who connected me with some First Nations speakers. So to get the, you know, modern Ojibwa has a lot of French and English words in it. We tried to recreate the pre-Columbian Ojibwa as closely as we could. So I'm very grateful to them for taking the time to assist with that. Also just creating a new criminal justice system and transportation, what would a village look like in the present day? And also just the time frame. I started by thinking, okay, starting from 1491 going forward, how does the world look different? And then, you know, you're thinking, okay, if there was no New World colonization, was there an African slave trade? And if there's not, you know, does that mean that the colonial powers were looking elsewhere, or did they just not do it? What does Asia look like? What does, you know, the rest of, you know, how cohesive are the tribes amongst themselves? You see that there's some tension between Chibonacci, who's Anishinaabe, and a Lakota person he sees on the train. There's some existing prejudice there. Would you have gas-powered vehicles? Just, you know, you can go on and on for a long time. I really encourage people to do so. There's a lot of different ways you can go. I hadn't seen a lot of books that did this, but I hope to see more going forward.
Yeah, it was a wonderful read, and I'm looking forward to getting a copy of The Mother, the book you wrote after, which, as you said earlier, is set in the UK. But in the meantime, I've enjoyed very much The Peacekeeper, and I thank you so much for taking an hour with us. It's most much appreciated. It's a great book, and thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our guest today, Brooke Blanchard. She writes under B.L. Blanchard, and the book is titled The Peacekeeper. If you haven't had a chance to look at it, I encourage you to take a look. And it did inspire our next segment of our program coming up. I'm Larry Mealer for WPR News.